This week on Making Contact.
Our primary contribution to this mess that Mexico is in is border enforcement. The more border enforcement you get, the more organized crime you get.
We've all heard about the violence resulting from the Mexican drug trade, but how did things get so bad? And 6 years into a militaristic drug war strategy employed by Mexico's government, why are things even worse?
When this first started out, there was a lot of support for it because the drug cartels are brutal. Then what we began to see are the statistics.
On this edition, political science professor David Shirk sheds light on the history and politics of the war on drugs in Mexico. And an emerging movement points to how both Mexicans and Americans can play a role in creating change. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. On May 8, 2011, the streets of Mexico City's main square were filled. An estimated 200,000 people shouted for President Felipe Calderón to change the government's involvement in the ongoing drug war or to step down. The day was historic. Organized by the Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity in a matter of weeks, it signified the arrival of the largest movement in the world against the so-called war on drugs. Eder Sanchez lives in Mexico City.
Calderón is trying to make people believe that the country is fighting against violence. But it's not really like that. Because if they really cared about people's well-being, they'd make sure that everyone has a place to live, a car, and security. There's always insecurity. It's like pretending to cover the sun with one finger. They're not focused on well-being. It's just a mafia.
When he took office in 2006, President Calderón stepped up the military offensive on the drug cartels, which led to increased retaliation and many innocent victims caught in the crossfire. In the past 6 years, almost 50,000 people have been killed. Juarez resident Olga Reyes, who's had 6 members of her family killed, read a long list of names. After each, the crowd chanted back, "They shouldn't have died."
Andrés Alonso García Duarte, mi hijo. Carlos Alan Santos Martínez.
Family members of the victims have been the heart of the Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity. Their leader, so to speak, is Mexican poet Javier Cecilia, whose 26-year-old son was killed in March of 2011.
Los partidos políticos, el PAN, el PRI, el
PRD, the political parties, the PAN, the PRI, the PRD, the PT, Convergencia, Nueva Alianza, the PANAL, the Verde, have become a partyocracy from whose ranks emerge the nation's leaders. In all of them, there are links to crime and the mafias across the entire nation. Without a real cleaning up of their ranks and a total commitment to an ethics policy, the public will have to ask ourselves in the next elections, for what cartel and for what powerful faction will we have to vote?
Elections are now looming in Mexico. With the choice of a new president on July 1, 2012, there's the possibility that Mexico's drug war strategy will take a new direction. So what can we learn from the past? What's likely to take place on July 1st and beyond? In January, University of San Diego political science professor David Shirk gave his take on what we might expect. As part of the Lannan Foundation's Readings and Conversation series, Shirk, who's also the principal investigator for the Trans-Border Institute's Justice in Mexico project, examines the history of Mexican politics and the violence brought on by the drug trade from the 1970s to today.
Democracy, participatory government, the choosing of our elected leaders, the exercising of democratic privileges like the right to free speech, etc., the idea of democracy rests on a notion somehow that rules are being followed. And so, in my view, democracy and the rule of law necessarily go hand in hand. In a democratic system, you have to have rules, and a democratic system has to have rules that are just. Leaders are expected to be accountable, and so on. And so when we think about Mexico's transition to democracy, Mexico's political changes of the 1990s, we start to recognize that the building of the rule of law was a critical component that, in retrospect, was severely lacking. And this is what we were starting to look at right around the victory of the opposition party, the National Action Party, and the opposition candidate Vicente Fox in the year 2000. We started asking the question, well, what's Mexico going to do now? How is it going to strengthen its police forces, its judiciary, and create a system that can maintain a democratic rule of law, not just order, not just a single dominant party telling everybody what to do, but a system that operates on the notion of democratic freedoms and the principles of democracy, but also has the necessary means to ensure that people obey the law, that people in government respect the law, and that the law ultimately is just and justly applied. And in 2000, I was very optimistic. I thought that Mexico was going to experience a dramatic improvement in the rule of law over the next, say, 10 or 15 years, thanks to the advent of democracy. But what we found, unfortunately, over this last decade, is that the security situation became a spiral, a downward spiral of continued crime and ever-worsening violence. And so that's the topic that I want to discuss with you tonight, and I want to take on, initially, some of the big ideas, some of the big misconceptions that I think are out there about this violence, and discuss those, and then move on to explain how Mexico got into this situation in the first place. So, how bad is it? Things are arguably bad in Mexico. We know this. We see the news. We see homicides. We see violence. It's not quite as bad as Ecuador, Equatorial New Guinea, Panama, St. Vincent, Dominica, Brazil, Dominican Republic, St. Lucia, Puerto Rico, the Bahamas, Colombia, Trinidad and Tobago, Guatemala, Belize, Venezuela, El Salvador, and Honduras, the countries that have higher homicide rates than Mexico in this hemisphere. Mexico is actually about average on homicide. These are the 2010 homicide figures for Mexico. It's about 18 per 100,000. That's really bad compared to the United States. It's about almost four times, the level of homicide we have in the United States. But keep in mind, we're at a record low in U.S. homicide rates. So Mexico actually doesn't look that bad. You have to actually hit 20 per homicides per 100,000 to be at a level that the World Health Organization considers to be an epidemic level of homicide. But you would go to Belize. You'd probably go to Belize. You'd probably go to Brazil or Colombia. Colombia's got such a fantastic reputation now for having improved the situation there, and yet it has almost a third more homicides per capita than Mexico. What's more is the decline of homicide in Mexico from the 1920s up until about 2005. So over time, Mexico has actually seen a lot of improvement on its overall levels of homicide. And when we compare that kind of violence to the kinds of violence that began to increase after the peso devaluation, robbery and assault, those are the kinds of crimes we were beginning to see, petty crimes, common crimes in the 1990s that were starting to get people a little bit worried and nervous about the security situation. So I need to explain a little bit how we got to where we are and what the real situation of violence is in Mexico. What I always try to get my students to focus on is The Godfather. The Godfather illustrates a critical transformation in organized crime in the United States, when it was looking for new areas of profitability. And some of the old guys, the Don Corleones, didn't want to go into drug trafficking. But they ultimately had to if they wanted to survive as criminal organizations. They also went into prostitution, into gambling. But organized crime groups are always looking for the quick and easy dime that can be made in a black market space. The Colombians worked with subsidiary organizations, the Mexicans and so on, but they pretty much dominated the control of the cocaine industry until the effort to squeeze drug traffickers out of the Gulf of Mexico, and also, of course, the crackdown on the Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel in the 1980s and 90s back in Colombia was critical for shifting the flow of drug trafficking from the Gulf of Mexico into Mexico. It started, of course, in the 1980s, the early networks. There were two big cartels, one of them much bigger than the other, the Gulf cartel, founded by a guy named Juan Nepomuceno Guerra, who later transferred his responsibilities to his nephew, Juan Garcia Abrego. They ran one of the oldest drug trafficking networks in Mexico. It dated back to the Prohibition era, 1930s. But they were relatively small time compared to the Guadalajara cartel, which was beginning to move in cocaine, thanks to guys like Ernesto Fonseca Carrillo and his apprentices, Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo and Rafael Caro Quintero. These guys were able to operate on a scale and at a level that the Colombian cartels had never, ever achieved. They were operating with such total impunity that they had, these guys walked around with badges that said that they were from the Federal Police Force, the DFS. They had the backing of someone or some group in the power structure, unlike anything we had seen in Colombia. And that was in part thanks to the fact that Mexico was a monopolistic society. In some ways, it still is a monopolistic society. You had one single party in power, one single group in power. And if you could get the guys up top to offer you protection, you could do anything you wanted. And that was how they operated until they went too far. When they killed Kiki Camarena, a USDA agent, the United States was furious. President Reagan called President De La Madrid, and he said, look, you got to shut this rogue law enforcement agency down. It led to a major change in Mexico's orientation, and Mexico went after guys like Ernesto Fonseca and Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo, put them behind bars. They were able to still do stuff behind bars. They were able to still run their operations. But shortly after 1989, Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo realized that he had to change the way his organization operated and the way that organized crime was going to run because there was a new pressure coming from authorities. So in the 1990s, what Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo decided to do was to redistribute power to his nephews and to the nephew of Fonseca and to try to create some kind of balance of power among various groups operating in drug trafficking in Mexico, to sort of carve out turf and say, look, you guys are going to have to run things from now on because I'm behind bars. So you get these three very different organizations, the Ariano Felix organization, the AFO, based in Tijuana. You get the Amado Carrillo Fuentes organization, actually the largest, most powerful organization of the 1990s. And you get a ragtag organization called the Sinaloa Cartel, run by Joaquin Chapo Guzman Loera and his mysterious, almost never seen partner, Ismael Zambada Garcia. Well, the 1990s was really the decade of the Juarez cartel. A new figure arrives on the scene in the mid-1990s, a guy named Ociel Cardenas, who betrayed some of his partners in the Gulf cartel to take over the organization and became known as the Mata Amigos, the friend killer. So these were the four figures, the four key pillars of Mexican drug trafficking. Things were a little bit ugly. There was violence, but they were mostly targeting each other. You might have a couple of hundred killings a year, but it was all kept in shop. Well, we enter the 2000s, and we see these four organizations begin to fight against each other and to take out each other's leadership and to squabble over turf in a way that leads to a fragmentation. They start breaking apart. They start losing their cohesiveness. You see the emergence of new groups like the La Familia Michoacana organization. Based in Michoacan, they formed initially because they hated drug traffickers, but then they decided it was just too profitable. They decided to join the drug traffickers. They spent most of their time originally trying to keep the meth dealers out, and then they said, well, what the heck, let's just deal meth. They came onto the scene and separated from the Gulf cartel in 2006. And then we saw the emergence of the Zetas. Now, the Zetas actually showed up in the late 90s. They were part of an elite military unit known as the GAFI, Special Forces Air Mobile Group. They were specially trained, specially vetted, and highly paid as a counter-drug force. This was the military at its finest. And as soon as OCL Cardenas saw those guys in action, he said, how do I get some of those guys? He just came up with a higher paycheck, and he had 30 or 40 of them on his payroll instantly, who began training an entire army that now numbers, some people estimate, in the thousands of paramilitary-style criminal organization. And then there were the Beltran Leyvas, who felt betrayed, for some reason, by Chapo Guzman from the Sinaloa cartel. He allegedly allowed one of the brothers to be arrested. The Beltran Leyva family got upset, and they broke away and started fighting against the Sinaloa cartel with their friends in the Juarez cartel. This is all very complicated. There's a lot more to it than I'm describing. But where we are today is either a situation where the Sinaloa cartel is going to successfully eliminate all of these rivals, many of the people that I just described, the El Teo organization. They've been basically disbanded. The Mexican government came in and arrested most of them. So the question is whether or not we will see a sort of continued fragmentation of organized crime in Mexico, which is likely to get more and more bloody, or will we see a consolidation of power among one or two big cartels, like we saw back in the 1980s and 90s. That very much, I think, depends on politics. Is Mexico going to have a hegemonic, single-party system anytime in the near future? The political cohesiveness of Mexico and the extent to which drug traffickers can make deals at very high levels, I think will determine whether or not they're able to get back to business as usual or whether they have to keep fighting amongst each other.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. We now return to political science professor David Shirk, speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico in January 2012 as part of the Lannan Foundation's Readings and Conversation series.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the toll of violence, and this is where it gets a little ugly. What we know about the violence, first of all, is that it's not everywhere. It's not all of Mexico that's on fire. This violence is heavily concentrated in key drug trafficking, producing, transportation corridors. But the other thing that we see in terms of violence in Mexico in recent years is that the violence grew dramatically over the course of the 2008s and 2009s. It just continued to grow almost exponentially each month and each year until about mid-2011. And what we started to see in mid-2011, we hope, is the beginning of a reversal. Violence is way down in the latter part of 2011 compared to other years. And we're trying to be very cautious about making any predictions, but the data seem to point to a downward trend. The problem, of course, is that we still see the overall trend for 2011 is about an 11% increase over the previous year. And that's because places like Monterrey, Veracruz, Jalisco have become the new spikers, the new increases in violence that have sustained a very high level of violent criminal activity in Mexico. We're talking about massive improvements in the northwestern portion of Mexico, but in the tender center, where a lot of the population is concentrated, where a lot of the economic activity is concentrated, the violence is getting worse. And that, I think, is a cause for serious pause and serious concern. So, are we winning? Are we having success? After 50,000 lives, are we winning, and who's to blame? The current president of Mexico, Felipe Calderón, came into office and said he was going to transform drug trafficking organizations from a national security problem into a public security problem, into a local problem, which would be fine if you had a functioning local police force, but that's one of the problems Mexico has. So Mexico's engaged in a three-pronged strategy. One is to eradicate production. They've been doing this for decades. The other is to interdict smuggling routes and try to stop, catch drugs in transit. And the third is taking out the bad guys, as I've alluded to here. Well, first of all, on crop eradication, we are eradicating some crops. We are taking out the cannabis or marijuana. We are taking out the opium poppy, which are the two main naturally grown products that Mexico produces, and that's arguably success, except for the fact that the productive capacity, the number of acres that are being allocated to production of these particular drugs that are growing, has grown as well. So our success may merely reflect an increase in volume. We're also putting a heck of a lot of guys behind bars. Calderón has put more people behind bars than any other president in Mexico, and has done so at an astonishing rate. But it also comes at a real cost in terms of civil liberties. There have been numerous allegations of corruption and human rights abuses by the military. And importantly, these efforts to break up cartel organizations is what I like to call the Fantasia strategy. Because, you know, when you say you want to break them down into smaller, more manageable pieces, which is what the Calderón administration has said from the beginning, you have to understand that smaller does not mean more manageable. And that's why Mexico's violence has spiraled out of control. We're breaking them up, and they're going from these sort of gentlemen Don Corleone types to being these thugs who have no scruples, and they will stop at nothing to make an extra buck in the drug trade. This is why many Mexicans are fed up. This is why, arguably, you know, if we saw 50,000 people being killed in our streets in the United States, we would pick up a sign and march and say, this has to stop. And that's what's beginning to happen in Mexico, thanks to people like Javier Cecilia, thanks to people like Alejandro Martí. The sad reality, though, is that those people stood up because they lost loved ones, because their sons were killed in this violence, and their sons were almost assuredly innocent of any involvement in organized crime. So let me bring this to a close, and I don't want to close without saying something about us, about our responsibility in the United States. Our primary contribution to this mess that Mexico is in is border enforcement. And the irony is that the more border enforcement you get, the more organized crime you get. We started enforcing the border in the 1990s. Suddenly, migrants who used to just walk across the border found that they needed a smuggler to get them across, and that they had to pay that smuggler $1,500 or $3,000 to get them across. Well, those coyotes became part of a vast network of organized crime that began to develop in response or retaliation to our tougher border security. Now, if you want to get drugs across the border, you can't just walk across. You have to dig a tunnel. Well, it takes about $1 million to build a good long tunnel across the border that's well enforced, it's got ventilation and tracks. That's what they're doing. And they're doing that to the circumvention of the tens of billions of dollars that we spend each year on border enforcement. We're also partly to blame for the violence because some significant percentage, and someone always argues with me about what's the percentage, it doesn't matter, some significant percentage of our guns are being pointed right back at us. They're coming to Mexico because we are the best manufacturer, the world's greatest manufacturer and supplier of firearms. But our big role, of course, our protagonist role in this of course, is our use of drugs. And I think we have to ask a question about, first of all, what's wrong with us? Why, if we're the greatest country in the world, why are we so chemically dependent? We have not changed our pattern of drug consumption in the last 30 years. But you know, one out of 20 arrests, 6% of U.S. arrests, are marijuana offenses, and mostly minor possession. We're putting basically about 100 people away an hour, or charging them at least with marijuana offenses. And where do they wind up? No use to us at all. In our correctional facilities, they become a wasted generation, most of them minorities, because they're easy to target. But I think we need to think about what we can do. And I'll leave you with five ideas. One is, get informed. It's easy to see the front pages and sort of say, oh, more drug trafficking in Mexico. But I think we need to pay attention to what's happening in Mexico, because Mexico matters to the United States. Second thing you can do is don't use drugs. I know it sounds very cliche, but my students spend more time thinking about the ethics of what they eat or what shoes they're wearing, what Nike shoes they're wearing, where it came from, than where they get the stuff on the weekend at the party, right? So if you want to use drugs, but you don't want an unethical supply chain, then you've got to lobby for change. Otherwise, you're complicit, and you're putting money in the pockets of El Chapo Guzman. You can also help to support some of the really important anti-violence efforts that are sparking up in Mexico. And the other thing you could do is don't be too afraid to go to Mexico. Understand that, as I said, the violence is very concentrated. Your odds of being killed by a drug trafficker in Mexico are very, very low, unless you are a drug trafficker. So keep that in mind.
March 28th, 2012. It's been 1 year since the Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity began. Two massive caravans have traveled through both the north and south of Mexico, bringing together victims of the drug war and, to some degree, unifying the nation's sentiment that the current strategy isn't working. On the central plaza of the town of Cuernavaca, where the movement began in 2011, a couple of hundred people are gathered to mark the day, including organizer Raúl Romero.
The great achievement of this movement is that it has created public debate about the issue that the militarization and security strategy adopted by this government is not the correct one.
Romero says he's pessimistic that this summer's elections can bring much in the way of change. The movement is instead turning their organizing efforts northward, to the United States.
We're not looking to blame the Americans. We're working to make new connections with Americans who are also suffering the consequences of militarization.
Cornell University PhD student Janice Gallagher has been accompanying the Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity and is helping organize a caravan in the U.S. this coming August. It will leave San Diego and pass through Arizona, Texas, Chicago, and end up in Washington, D.C.
So we all know that the war on drugs in the U.S. isn't helping, right? People are still using drugs. Our prisons are full of nonviolent offenders. So we know the drug war isn't working. And guess what? It's not working for the Americans, and it's not working for Mexicans. If we can get together on the things that aren't working, I think we have a greater opportunity for policy change.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to the Lannan Foundation. For audio and video of David Shirk's full-length lecture, along with a discussion, log on to our website, radioproject.org. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.